You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review, and today we're heading to the West End here in London, where we'll be learning the magic of the stage with Harry Potter. We'll also watch a classic with a sunny backdrop as Jesus Christ Superstar hits Regent's Park, and we'll find out how well Rebel Wilson fares in the Broadway classic Guys and Dolls. And talking me through all three is the theatre critic Matt Wolfe. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, Matt, our first stop today is at the Palace Theatre for the hotly anticipated J.K. Rowling play, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Now, here we meet Harry 19 years after the end of the final book. He's working on the Ministry of Magic and he has three children, including son Albus Cerevis Potter. I hope I've said that right. Whose story we will follow in this play. Matt, there will be millions of fans, obviously, excited to hear about this play all around the world. So far, only those lucky enough to score some tickets here in London will be able to solve that mystery.
Yes.
Let us in. What's it all like?
Well, it's very exciting. The plot details probably have to be kept slightly under wraps. At the end of both halves, it's in two halves that together take about 5.5 hours. And at the end of both halves, you're given little buttons that say, keep the secrets. And the buttons are different for each half. They face different directions. So there's, you know, a great tradition of theatrical marathons, but I don't think there's ever been a theatrical marathon derived from such a populist and popular source. So the question about this is, we know Harry Potter the books, we know Harry Potter the films. What's going to be like on stage? Is it just going to be an exercise in cynicism? And I think really the most exciting thing about the production, to say first off, is that it actually comes from the heart. And in a way, the plays are really about a rediscovery of the heart. They're quite emotional, particularly the second one. So it doesn't just look like, oh yeah, let's just trot out lots of merchandising. These are proper plays written by a proper playwright, Jack Thorne, directed by a real director, John Tiffany. And the interesting thing is, the main characters, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and Ron and Hermione now have got married, and they, you know, there are lots of kids in this. But really, the emphasis isn't so much on Harry and Hermione approaching middle age. It's more on the next generation, particularly Harry's the kind of neglected son whom you mentioned, and then the son of Draco Malfoy, who is, was Harry's nemesis, but his son, Scorpius, is a good chum of Harry's son. So the question is, will the next generation find a rapport that the previous generation didn't, and what sorts of adventures will these two young men go on? Beyond that, there isn't really much you can say without giving a lot away. The familiar figures from the books and the movies make, you know, varying degrees of cameo appearances, but the plot hinges on something called a time turner. And if you can figure out the intricacies of the time turner and how it works, you're a much smarter man than I, because I was sitting there going, huh? But I'm not that well versed in kind of the mechanics of fantasy literature. And I think if you were, all of this would make perfect sense. Which is a way of saying that you can't worry too much about the device that powers the plot. You just have to revel in where the plot takes you.
Well, of course. That's what Hitchcock would call a MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Let's talk then about, I know I kind of winced when you said the length of the play. I mean, it's I like to kind of draw it back sometimes to ordering a dessert for your main meal. Sometimes, as delicious as it is, it can be a little bit too much. That's an awful long time to spend in the theatre, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, 5.5 hours, you know, that's less than 3 hours per play. If you were to go to 2 Shakespeare plays on a day, which certainly theatre critics do, I don't know if normal people do, but, you know, that would be 6 hours on a day. And the thing that is very interesting about blockbuster movies these days, and of course Harry Potter has been many blockbuster movies, is that they're very long. You know, you go
they're
to
all
a lot
too
of
long.
These. Yeah, you go to things like The Revenant, and that's easily as long as one of these plays. So, and of course you've got intervals, you've got a 2.5 hour break between the two, and you don't have to see them on one day.
At least there is an interval. That's a good point, actually. That horrible Batman versus Superman movie, to bring it back to movies, did not have an interval, and that was just, I mean, that was painful for many reasons, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So bring it back to the cast then, because I know you touched upon that. We are so used to seeing certain actors in these roles. Emma Watson, of course, you know, Daniel Radcliffe. We've seen them in these roles for so long.
Yeah.
What's it like to see other people playing these roles? Do you feel like you're watching something from the Harry Potter family?
You do. I mean, you feel as if what's great is they've matured, they've grown up, they've acquired a new sort of way of being. In the case of Hermione, a way of looking, it's not in any way a spoiler to say that there was a certain amount of discussion about the fact that there's a wonderful black actress, Nema Dumezweni, playing Hermione. People didn't expect that. J.K. Rowling was the first to point out quite rightly that, you know, ethnicity was never specified in the books. And, you know, this is a rainbow universe. This isn't just, you know, kind of white men and women doing kind of fantastical things. And one of the very interesting things in the production is the very first actor you see on stage is a black actor, Chris Jarman, who is one of the people who decides which house at Hogwarts the different young people should be in. So it's kind of a motley, you know, all-embracing universe. And so within that, you have these new people taking on the familiar mantle. It's interesting, Jamie Parker, who was in Guys and Dolls prior to Rebel Wilson joining, he got out just in the nick of time. Jamie Parker has the kind of glasses and something of kind of the furrowed brow, but he takes it in a very different direction from where Dan Radcliffe did, but it's also a character at a different point in his life. Of the three that we know best, Ron, played now by Paul Thornley, is probably the one most recognizable from before because he's still essentially a figure of fun. He says, hey, I'm the really chilled out one here. And that's what he turns out to be. There's not a lot of depth there. The real standout is this young actor, Anthony Boyle, who plays Scorpius, who I had not heard of this guy before. And he is the breakout star of the play. And I think it's going to do all sorts of great things for him.
Lots to look forward to there. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child is on at the Palace Theatre here in London. It is scheduled to hit North American theatres next year, and brace yourselves because the book of the play will be released on July the 31st. Well, let's head outside now for our second play today. Jesus Christ Superstar is showing here in Regent's Park at the Open Air Theatre. Matt, now that summer has, well, it's well and truly hit London, as we've noticed over the past few days, would you say this is a worthwhile way to take in a play?
I would. I mean, there's a great tradition of the Open Air Theatre in Regent's Park kind of having the musical, which they usually do in this slot, the kind of July going into August slot. And the musical can be, you know, a Broadway classic. You know, they did Crazy for You a few years ago. I'm sure in their time they've done Guys and Dolls. Or it can be a British classic like Jesus Christ Superstar. The funny thing about Jesus Christ Superstar, which began as a concept album in 1970, and then it became a Broadway show, and then it became a West End hit that ran for years and years and years, much bigger hit in London than New York, is that in my experience of it, it's never worked on stage until now. And the best thing about this production, directed by Timothy Shooter, is that he doesn't try to fuss with it. He basically treats it as a gig. You know, it began as a rock concert, rock concept album back when Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice were, you know, kind of these young rock dudes. It's kind of hard to imagine that now, but that was them then. And every production since then, except for this one, has tried to sort of disguise that or gussy it up or make it something it isn't.
Turn it into some sort of big stage, sort of spectacular.
Exactly. And I didn't see it, but there was an arena version a few years ago with Tim Minchin, the Australian guy, one of the people behind Matilda. But anyway, this production just treats it as, first of all, a series of really good songs. I mean, those songs are catchy. They do get under your skin. The staging is there, and it's actually simple yet sophisticated, if that makes sense. The set, which is very clever, it shows you a kind of cross lying on the ground, and you think, well, I know what that's going to be like. But actually, there are surprises within that, which I won't give away. But basically, you've got Declan Bennett as a kind of sandal-wearing, guitar-strumming troubadour Jesus, and this amazing newcomer named Tyrone Huntley playing Judas, and that's the kind of powering dynamic. And then beyond that, you just go with the story, which we all know. The emotions here are treated very genuinely, but not over the top. And it's quite exciting. And it's particularly exciting outside, because as it gets darker, I mean, in real life, so, of course, does the story. By the end, the kind of crucifix is emitting a sulfurous glow. And it's all very evocative. There has been some talk of moving the production when it finishes in August, moving the production to West End Theatre, which, of course, be indoors. And I can't quite see how that would work.
So you're really speaking up the fact that it is actually outside then. That really plays an integral role to enjoying this.
It does. It does. I mean, there's something about that theatre, more often than not, tries to utilize its alfresco setting. For instance, last year there was a production of Chekhov's The Seagull, not a musical, admittedly, but a play, where at the beginning two of the characters went swimming. So you saw them, I mean, they actually went swimming, so you saw them emerging dripping wet. They don't do that here, although Jesus by the end of the show is dripping wet, but for different reasons. And there's, you know, kind of this frenzied choreography by Drew McConey, which by the end, it's like watching a Donald Trump rally run amok. And so there's a lot about kind of mob rule, but all of that is just kind of given up to you without comment. You can make of it what you will, and then just let the music take over, which it does.
Jesus Christ Superstar is on at Regent's Park Open Air Theatre until Sunday the 27th of August. Now finally, Matt, we're ending up at the Phoenix Theatre here in London to catch Rebel Wilson in the latest production of Guys and Dolls. Now this, of course, is a Broadway classic. It was first performed way back in 1950 and has won Tony Awards and has been performed over 1,000 times around the world. That's an awful lot of performances. Matt, before we talk about this particular production, what do you think of Guys and Dolls, perhaps just as a general show, as a classic?
Well, there are a lot of, you know, theater critics in their downtime have like to play parlor games, and one of them is, you know, what's the perfect musical? And there are lots of candidates, but the one that gets mentioned more than any other is Guys and Dolls because it is so irresistibly itself. It's got really pungent, idiosyncratic, lovable characters. It's got almost a kind of a Shakespearean setup of one central pair of lovers and then another central pair of lovers, and they kind of compare and contrast. It's got great dancing or great opportunities for dancing, but best of all, it has that immortal score by Frank Lesser, of whom Lesser, as they famously said, is morer. And the score is just wonderful. And you might think, depending on your age and your kind of awareness of musicals, you might think, oh, I don't really know musicals. I don't know that world. You will know these songs.
You know these songs,
even if
sure.
you think you don't.
Absolutely.
So that's the background into which Ms. Wilson is stepping.
I've seen Guys and Dolls on stage before. I enjoyed it. I find it quite bizarre that it's considered the perfect musical, though. I found it quite oddly old-fashioned. It feels a little bit rusty by today's standards. A lot of the themes that permeate from the plot don't seem to really gel with what we would expect from a storyline today. Am I reading perhaps a little bit too much into it?
I think you're reading too much into it. I mean, it's a wonderful dynamic between you've got Nathan Detroit and Miss Adelaide on the one hand, Miss Adelaide being the character Rebel Wilson's now playing, and they're, you know, kind of, well, she's literally, she thinks, always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Are they ever going to get married? What will it take to get Nathan to propose to her, even though she's already told her mother that they have five children and there's a sixth on the way? So there's that kind of, he, you know, he's a guy, he refuses to commit, he refuses to be drawn on his affections. So there's that journey. Then on the other hand, you've got this feckless younger gambler, Skye Masterson, who's all too quick to pounce. Nathan won't pounce at all, and Skye's too quick to pounce, and so he, in a bet, because it's set against the backdrop of gambling, but it's fun gambling. It's not, this isn't, you know, we're not talking The Godfather here. So Skye Masterson, on a bet, takes this mission doll, the Salvation Army, you know, kind of very upright but attractive young woman, Sister Sarah, to Havana. I've always thought the only strange thing about the plot is they never tell you what in heaven's name does Skye and Sister Sarah talk about on the flight to Havana and on the flight back. Well, on the flight back, she's drunk, so she probably falls asleep. But on the way there, what do they talk about? They don't know each other. But it's just, and also a little bit like Harry Potter, but totally different manifestation. It's got a great heart. I mean, it's very sweet.
So many, as you mentioned earlier, so many very, very catchy songs. Let's talk about Rebel Wilson in the role then, because we've seen her in lots of different roles now, mostly on the cinema screen.
Yeah.
Here she is embodying a very, very famous musical. How does she fare?
Well, the interesting thing about her, I gather, is that her background is on stage. And so she was doing stage before, you know, the rest of the world discovered who she was and is. And I think her commitment to this is very genuine. She's in it for 8 weeks. There was some talk about, oh, she wouldn't do matinees. And she said, rubbish, I'm going to do every performance for 8 weeks, whatever it is. But the fact of the matter is, she's just not a very good fit for the part. I know there are some people who've said, oh, she revivifies the part, but I just think, to be honest with you, she cheapens the part because, you know, she's a little too young. That's all right. That's forgivable. You don't have to be absolutely age appropriate. But what's less forgivable is she brings a kind of reckless chaffiness, for lack of a better phrase, to the role, which isn't quite what you think of when you think of Miss Adelaide working as a hotbox girl. That could mean a lot of things, but it probably doesn't mean, for instance, that she drops her voice and does very funny, funny in inverted commas, impersonations that make her sound slightly challenged, if you know what I mean. And then she'll start doing all this weird miming and semaphoring, like, for instance, the business with the children. She sort of pays a lot of attention to her nether regions, and we kind of get the idea that, yes, that's probably where children come from. But I'm not quite sure that that's the Miss Adelaide that Nathan is drawn to, however hard it is for him to say. I mean, if I were Nathan and this was the Miss Adelaide in my midst, I might think, I'm not sure whether I really do want to go through with this, as opposed to, of course I do, you're irresistible. So she erects a kind of, the net result of this, for me anyway, is that she erects a barrier, in fact, between herself and the role. You end up not seeing the role, and you see her commentary on the role, or her subverting the role to make it all about what she can do. And what I think great performers do is they accommodate themselves to the role. They don't accommodate the role to them.
Mm, perhaps recalling her past in Bogan Pride on Australian television a little bit too.
Which I have not seen, but I take it on good faith.
Now, just really, really quickly, we do have to wrap up. If some of our listeners are unlucky enough not to be able to make it here in London to see Guys and Dolls, is it worth them revisiting the cinematic version starring Marlon Brando?
No, I would wait and see it live.
There you go, recommendation for you there. Okay, so Guys and Dolls is on at the Phoenix Theatre until the 25th of January next year. And that indeed brings us to the end of today's show, thanks to my guest, Matt Wolfe. You have been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our book review. But for now, thanks for listening and bye-bye.